what's
going on. Okay, here we are, only almost 15 minutes late, 10 minutes late maybe. Yeah, it's just so many things to try to remember when I leave the house in the morning. So where we are, we've been talking about, well, I think, believe it or not, next week, we will actually start on William James. What a concept. Because I've been pursuing the background to all this, because I think it's important to understand where this comes from, and pragmatism itself derives from the positivistic movement. And of course, for the last, ever since the beginning of September, we talked about sort of origins with Newton, even though he's not a philosopher, and then the real theorists that are responsible for the development of what we now call positivism, and that's Hume and Kant. We spent a number of weeks on both of them. And then last week, I hadn't originally planned to do it, but it just occurred to me that it might be interesting for people if we said a little bit about the man to whom we owe the word positivism, because you and Kant, they wouldn't know what you were talking about if you said you're a positivist. And that's Auguste Comte, and I spent last week talking about a very brief selection from the beginning of his course on positive philosophy, where he uses the word in the way that we use it nowadays, which is the idea, of course, that the only thing that really counts as knowledge is what we know scientifically, and if you don't know it scientifically, it ain't knowledge. And then Comte also had this interesting, I think it's interesting, but very, very huge generalization of all of history as going through three stages: the theological stage, the metaphysical stage, and the positive stage. So it's this, I even characterized it, although he doesn't, he sees it as a progression, but I could see it as a Hegelian kind of thing, where you start off with people whose only linguistic tools are descriptions of particular events, not abstractions. And that's the theological stage, so trying to explain things. Well, how do they do it? Well, in terms of stories, that's how, because that's what they had at their disposal. And then the discovery of abstract thought, and I'm taking it in this Hegelian sense, and they just go hog wild and all these, you know, really, really general abstractions that are, some of which are scientific by our lights, but some of which are just utter speculation beyond the bounds of sense. And then the positivist movement then is to sort of get the balance right between the two. You're still using theories and understanding the world in an abstract way, but you're not using the abstract language irresponsibly to just speculate on things that can never be, questions that can never be answered. So, I mean, you could, that's not the way Comte portrays it, but that's the way you could interpret it in a Hegelian sort of way. Well, anyway, so but today I want to talk about Charles Sanders Peirce, and I think you'll find it interesting. Peirce was mostly a logician. I just came across a comment by the editor. This is another book of his writings, by the editor of the book that I thought was interesting. Actually, just this morning, my eye fell on it. But this is interesting as a generalization about Peirce versus James. This is what the editor says. The chief difference between Peirce's pragmatism, well, Peirce renamed it pragmaticism because William James took over the idea of pragmatism, and Peirce was so disgusted at the direction that James had taken things that he renamed his position pragmaticism. So the chief difference between Peirce's pragmaticism and James's pragmatism arises from the fact that Peirce's point of view is logical, whereas James's is psychological. Whereas Peirce sought the meaning of a proposition in its logical and experimentally testable consequences, James looked far more immediately, immediately felt sensations and personal reactions. And then, of course, the editor goes on to say that sort of difference of the starting point had a lot of after effects if you work it out. And then, actually, the end quotes from Peirce where Peirce is critiquing William James, and at the end of his little critique, he says, we must certainly guard ourselves against understanding this rule, which we'll talk about in a minute, the pragmatic rule, in too individualistic a sense. See, I think that's the, from Peirce's point of view, that's the problem with William James, is that psychological point of view, that psychological starting point that William James began with, really winds up being kind of subjective in a lot of ways and individualistic, whereas Peirce is, I'm talking about different from Peirce and James. We actually got to the Americans today. So whereas Peirce's logical perspective is set up not to allow for these individual differences. But we'll see this. Maybe I'll revisit this little comment when we've gone through Peirce and on our way to talking about William James. But anyway, that's an interesting way of thinking about it. So what I'm saying is then that when you get to Peirce, the pragmatic ideas that we find in Peirce, or the development of pragmatism that we find in Peirce, is really an offshoot of positivism. Peirce himself was rather critical of Comte because he felt it was too narrow. Remember, I've said repeatedly, I guess, in answer to Tom's question of about 2 months ago, you can draw this line either more narrowly or more broadly. By the time you get to William James, it's pretty big, but Comte is narrower, actually, even than Hume, Kant. And the logical positivists of the 1930s really drew it tightly and excluded more than even Hume, Kant do. So it just depends on where you draw that circle or how big the circle is. Peirce thinks that Comte drew the circle too narrowly, and it did not include religion, for one thing. And so he doesn't go all the way with Comte, well, although he generally admires that direction, of course, because pragmatism is really just a branch of positivism. It's just an American branch of positivism. So that was why I spent the time going over all those proto-positivists, Hume, Kant, and then all those Comte. So anyway, in 1870 something or other, 78 maybe. I don't know if the does it have a little footnote saying when this was. 1877, Popular Science Monthly. A lot of what Peirce wrote is rather technical, as I say, since he was a logician. That's not so surprising. But in 1877, in Popular Science Monthly, he wrote 6 essays, the first 2 of which I was going to talk about. And the 6 essays, actually, they're all in here, and the titles of them are The Fixation of Belief, How to Make Our Ideas Clear, The Doctrine of Chances, The Probability of Induction, The Order of Nature, and Deduction, Induction on Hypothesis. And as you can see, the last 4 are much more, I guess, logic-oriented. But the first 2 are sort of general discussions of knowledge. The Fixation of Belief and How to Make Our Ideas Clear. Those are questions of knowledge. And so let's see, first of all, what he means by the title, The Fixation of Belief. He starts off sort of, before he actually gets to his main topic, he sort of starts off with a little bit of background, I guess you might say. He starts talking about doubt and belief. He says, thus both doubt and belief have positive effects upon us, though very different ones. Belief does not make an act at once, but puts us into such a condition that we shall behave, this is really important, behave in some certain way when the occasion arises. Doubt, though, has not the least such active effect, but stimulates us to inquiry until it is destroyed. Okay, so doubt, in other words, is an uncomfortable state to be in. When we're in doubt, what we want to do is destroy it, is remove the doubt. And doubt, then, is sort of a stimulus to belief. And the hallmark of belief, and this is, I think, probably the most important point when you're talking about the pragmatist, the hallmark of belief is that it issues in certain actions, certain types of behavior, that sort of thing. It's going to become important when we get to the actual definition of what pragmatism is. Okay? So, the irritation of doubt, he says, that's what he always used, that's the word he used, irritate. Doubt is uncomfortable. I said it's uncomfortable. He says it's irritating. So the irritation of doubt causes a struggle to attain a state of belief. Okay. We want to get to the kind of unirritated state. We want to get to the state where we can just kind of relax and not worry about it, and that's a state of belief when the doubt has been removed. The irritation of doubt is the only immediate motive for the struggle to attain belief. It is certainly best for us that our beliefs should be such as may truly guide our actions so as to satisfy our desires, and this reflection will make us reject every belief which does not seem to have been so formed as to ensure this result. But it will only do so by creating a doubt in the place of that belief. With the doubt, therefore, the struggle begins, and with the cessation of doubt, it ends. Hence, the sole object of inquiry is the settlement of opinion. So we start off with certain beliefs, certain doubts then arise from those beliefs, right? We, as you know, when we learn things about the world, that usually just raises other questions and so forth, and we're a curious species, according to Captain Picard, and therefore we want to resolve our curiosity. We want to answer our questions. We want to remove this irritation of doubt.
That's right, make it so.
Exactly, we want to make it so.
Well done.
Make it so. The most that can be maintained is that we seek for a belief that we think shall be true. That the settlement of opinion, then, is the sole end of inquiry. Okay, so, given that, we start with doubt, we want to attain belief, to remove the doubt and come out to to remove the irritation and come out with a more relaxed state of affairs. That means, that really is saying, what we want to do is fix belief. We want to fix belief. In other words, and that's the title of this essay, The Fixation of Beliefs. In other words, what techniques do we use for going about removing the doubt and settling back in some belief? Okay, the fixation of belief. There will be four ways in which we fix beliefs. We human beings fix belief. This is almost like a psychological observation, I guess. How does a human species go about fixing belief and removing the irritation of doubt? And there will be four ways of doing it. Number one, if the settlement of opinion is the sole object of inquiry, and if belief is of the nature of a habit, why should we not attain the desired end by taking as answer to a question any we may fancy, and constantly reiterating it to ourselves, dwelling on all which may conduce to that belief, and learning to turn with contempt and hatred from anything that might disturb it? This simple and direct method is really pursued by many men.
Did he just say talk yourself into it?
Still often there's the instinctive dislike of an undecided state of mind, exaggerated into a vague dread of doubt, makes men cling spasmodically to the views they already take. A man may go through life, I'm just picking out little sentences here and there. A man may go through life systematically keeping out of view all that might cause a change in his opinions. Okay. But this method of fixing belief, it is a method of fixing belief. Now, I'm going to quiz Marty. What is the slogan that represents this? I'm putting you on the spot. What is the slogan that represents this method of fixing belief?
Don't bother me, baby, the truth.
The bumper sticker?
My mind is made up.
Yeah, okay.
Oh, the one Jesus said it, I believe it, that settled it?
Yeah, that's right, or God said it, that's right, yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, they used to just drive, oh. I haven't seen that in decades, but it used to just drive me up the wall. I would see it every so often. And that's okay, that's number one method of fixing belief. God said it, I believe it, and that settles it. In other words, I'm not going to listen to it. Once I foolishly, one of the many foolish things I've done was I asked my cousin who, they went from church to church because no church was ever quite conservative enough, I guess. But they wound up someplace that they were more or less comfortable with. And so I foolishly offered once to actually come and maybe spend a few days down there. This is in Greensboro, North Carolina, and give a little course, like a Sunday school course, on Augustine, who is certainly a safe theologian. I mean, certainly very safe. And she thought about it a bit, and then she came back and she said, "I don't think that would work." I'm really glad she said that, by the way, because so-and-so, who is the minister at that church, thinks that every iota of anything connected with the church has to have the goal of, well, she didn't use the phrase fixing belief, but that's what she meant, fixing belief. Everything has to have that goal. And even something as safe as Augustine, who is the origin of Western Christian theology, just by even raising the questions, I suppose, might unfix some beliefs and cause, God forbid, doubt to arise. And that he just would never allow that. That's just not the purpose of church. The purpose of church, for his view, I mean, if indeed you take the Lutheran sort of tack that justification by faith alone, that's everything, faith is everything, why, if that's the case, then why would you even teach theology? Because if you put things into words, that can raise questions. So no theology here. Well, at least not except for maybe, basically no theology, I suppose. Well, anyway, those are the kinds of things I'm talking, well, that Peirce is talking about when he's talking about number one method of fixing belief, right? One last little quote. This method of fixing belief may be called the method of tenacity. I think that's pretty good. The method of tenacity. There is no way you're going to convince me that there wasn't fraud in the 2020 election. I love the comment, by the way. Sorry, I'm getting off into politics, but I think I'm safe here. the comment, I don't know if you saw this. I love this comment by the mayor of Hialeah, Florida, who said, "There is no doubt in my mind that there was massive fraud in 2020. But it's very hard to prove." And then my response is, "I think I know why it's very hard to prove." But the method of tenacity, right? That's the method of tenacity. About it doesn't have, you know, it doesn't have to be religious, of course. It could be anything. And if I'm determined to believe this, there is no because. I don't even have to tell you because. I don't have to supply a subordinate clause beginning with the word because. I'm just going to believe it, period, and I don't want to hear anything else. I'm going to stop up my ears. The method of tenacity will be unable, will be unable to hold its ground in practice. The social impulse is against it. The man who adopts it will find that other men, the more you limit your contact with other people, the better off you are. But anyway, Peirce says,
yeah, the political bubble.
The man. Go ahead.
Yeah, I mean the bubble.
Yeah. The man who adopts it will find that other men, guess what, think differently from him. And it will be apt to occur to him in some saner moment, he says, that their opinions are quite as good as his own, and this will shake his confidence in his belief. Maybe, maybe not. Anyway, so the method of tenacity then is fixation type one. Okay. All right, fixation type two. The problem becomes not to have a fixed belief, but the individual merely, but in the community. So now we're looking at it more widely, not in the individual case, but in the social case. Let the will of the state then act instead of that of the individual. In judging this method of fixing belief, which may be called the method of authority. Of course, it doesn't have to be the state either. I mean, it could be the church, like in the Middle Ages, the Catholic Church certainly exercised a great deal of psychological power. I mean, heck, they could, at its height, the Pope could overturn potentates, right? Such as King John or Henry the Fourth, was it? The Holy Roman Emperor? Innocent the Third was the powerful Pope. In judging this method of fixing beliefs, which may be called the method of authority, we must, in the first place, allow its immeasurable mental and moral superiority to the method of tenacity. Right? I mean, if the state comes along and controls, such as in China, say, controls all organs of communication, mm-hmm. and disallows, and not just China, of course, and disallows any sort of independent commentary on anything having to do with politics or any decisions that are made by the state authorities, and if everything they do is infallible, we never make mistakes, all we do is advertise the positive and suppress the negative, that is also using the method of authority. It's interesting. This is a little bit off the subject, I guess, but you know what philosophy is. Philosophy is a matter of uncovering the ultimate presuppositions with which we approach any given human activity. You know, any given human activity is going to involve certain, most of the time, assumed beliefs or premises, maybe you might say. And because they're assumed, usually we're unconscious of them. We don't even bother to or even think about thinking about them. And philosophers are the ones who are able to usually to, you know, ferret them out and at least bring them out into the light of day to ask the question, is there merit in this or not? Right? Maybe merit in it, but maybe not. You have to look at it and articulate it. Well, in a very broad sense, you could say that Thomas Aquinas, I'm putting words into his mouth a bit because I'm situating him in the vast panorama of intellectual history, but you could say that Aquinas is saying something like this, that antiquity has shown us that reason by itself can't adjudicate these questions when we bring into the light of day the premises that we're implicitly using in all of our human activities, be they ordinary action or scientific activities or anything, whatever, but bring them into light of day, and all of a sudden you have nothing but contested positions on these. Am I going to, is the good pleasure, or is the good contemplation, and that sort of thing? Do I rely on sense experience for knowledge, or do I rely on reason? And so we have these constant warring schools out there, and the history of philosophy and antiquity has shown that reason itself is incompetent to answer these questions once they have been brought into the light of day. Now, if you're Aquinas, you don't want to suppress them, you don't want to put them back in the dark, but your position is human reason is incapable of resolving these questions. But guess what? We have revelation. And that will supply us with those ultimate premises and therefore direction that we can go in when we try to reason about the consequences of these, that sort of thing. So in this case, what you're doing is you're allowing an authority, the authority of the church, right? Because it's a book, Revelation, but it's a book that has to be interpreted and interpreted by the doctors of the church. So what you're saying is that these ultimate premises then need to be supplied by the doctors of the church, the authority of, and, you know, in their favor, I would say, or their position. I mean, a current contemporary Catholic, I'm sure, would say, the great thing about Catholicism or Catholic theology is it's a group effort. And no individual is smart enough to figure this stuff out. But if we pool our resources, we'll be in better shape. And that, in fact, is what the Catholic Church has done, not just the collection of individuals at the present time, but the entire history of doctors of the church that have, everybody has added a little bit to the fund of theological knowledge, something along those lines. So indeed, the church has every right to tell you what you should think as far as those ultimate premises go. So, I mean, that's a reasoned argument, I suppose, for, I don't like it much, but that's a reasoned argument for the method of authority. That's what we're talking about. So it doesn't have to be the state. It might be the state. It might be the church. Some sort of powerful communal organ is the one that is fixing belief in this case, not the individual's biases and the method of tenacity, but the authority, whatever that authority is.
Would social media fit into that?
Oh, sure. But I mean, in the same way that I was talking earlier about, like in China, you're grabbing all of the organs of communication. And that would, of course, include social media. You can't allow somebody to have an independent opinion out here. And, well, if that person does, you better not open your mouth or type anything into Instagram or something like that. Yeah.
Cults as well. Just
I'm sorry?
Cults, like loonies.
Yeah, well, but I'm saying that in a state that's organized according to the method of authority, they would certainly have to control all organs of communication, and that would include just not just newspapers, the traditional organs, but also the newfangled ones like Instagram and Snapchat and all that stuff, right? Social media, basically. Anyway, these men possess a wider sort of social feeling. They see, of course, this is the problem with this method of fixing belief, though. They all, I mean, this is going to be a progressive kind of thing. they see that men in other countries, and this is communal, but guess what? There are other communes as well. They see that men in other countries and other ages have held to very different doctrines from those that they themselves have been brought up to believe, and they cannot help seeing that it is the mere accident of their having been taught as they have and of their having been surrounded with the manners and associations they have that has caused them to believe as they do and not far differently. Nor can their candor resist the reflection that there is no reason to rate their views at a higher value than those of other nations and of other centuries, thus giving rise to doubts in their minds. So far, both of these methods of fixing belief have sort of, well, as Hegel might say, contained their own internal contradiction that will eventually overthrow that method and lead to the next method of fixing belief. I maybe want to take that with a grain of salt. I mean, this is just a literary way of getting from one of the, you know, from one to the next method of fixing belief. Maybe. I don't know how seriously he took it. Because, you know, some closed societies, really maybe North Korea comes to mind, so far very effective at staying closed. Right. Okay, anyway, so what's number three? Okie dokie, number three. The willful adherence to a belief and the arbitrary forcing of it upon others must therefore both be given up. That's number one and number two, tenacity and authority. A different new method of settling opinions must be adopted that shall not only produce an impulse to believe, but shall also decide what proposition it is which is to be believed. Let the action of natural preferences be unimpeded then, and under their influence, let men conversing together and regarding matters in different lights gradually develop beliefs in harmony with natural causes. Systems of this sort have not usually rested upon any observed facts, though, at least not in any great degree. They have been chiefly adopted because their fundamental proposition seemed, quote, agreeable to reason. Now, this is, of course, going to be different from tenacity and authority, of course, and better, really, because at least it's rational and it's not forced either by my own stubbornness or by the authority of the state or the church or something. But nevertheless, this doesn't have a whole lot to do with facts. Something is believed because it is agreeable with reason, or to reason, agreeable to reason, he says. This is an apt expression. It does not mean that which agrees with experience, but that which we find ourselves inclined to believe. And of course, he's, well, let me just read a little more and then I'll say what I was going to say. This method is far more intellectual and respectable from the point of view of reason than either of the others, which we have noticed. Indeed, as long as no better method can be applied, it ought to be followed, since it is then the expression of instinct which must be the ultimate cause of belief in all cases. But its failure has been most manifest. It makes of inquiry something similar to the development of taste. So we're about to see the downfall of number three and go to number four. And so from this, which has been called the a priori method, we are driven, in Lord Bacon's phrase, to true induction. This method does not really differ in a very essential way from that of authority. There are some people among whom I must suppose that my reader is to be found, who, when they see that any belief of theirs is determined by any circumstances extraneous to the facts, will from that moment not merely admit in words that the belief is doubtful, but he will experience real doubt of it. And so this creates, in some degree at least, ceases in some degree at least to be a belief. So this method is the method of, the third one is the method of reason. When something is agreeable to reason. What does he mean by that? Well, I think you've all had the same experience. I can tell you, let me tell you about my experience with Sanskrit. When I retired, which was 5 years ago, that doesn't seem possible. 5 years ago. Well, anyway, I retired 5 years ago, and in the last maybe 15 years or so, I have really thought a lot and been intrigued by the possible influence of Indian thought on the late Roman Empire. I know I've said that in here numerous times, especially with Plotinus. But to really be able to make a case for that, you got to know the Sanskrit. I mean, that's where the Indian stuff is at. So I got a two-volume. I've talked about this, haven't I? In here, I can't remember. I got a two-volume kind of teach yourself Sanskrit thing by a guy named Egenes, and it's a typical language instruction business. You go have this lesson here, and then you have a bunch of sentences to translate, and so forth, and so on. Well, you know what? I didn't know this. It's absolutely phenomenal, and I was so excited that two or so years ago I taught a course at OLLI, which is where I've been teaching the last 5 years, on classical languages, and it's a slide. It's a slide show, PowerPoint centered course. I talked about Sanskrit, Greek, and Latin, and the attempt to recover what Proto-Indo-European must have been like, under the assumption that simplification over the centuries has been the rule, and so that if you take the most complex features of any of those three languages, then you maybe can approximate what Proto-Indo-European was like. That was the whole premise there. And, of course, since Sanskrit is even older than Greek, on average, Sanskrit literature, that really, I think, gives a lot. It's a great window into Proto-Indo-European. Well, anyway, though, what I didn't really appreciate, I kind of maybe knew it in the abstract, but I really didn't know the full import of it, was the Indians. Every nation excels in something or other, right? They were lousy on history. I can say that, and the result of that is it's almost impossible to date things in Indian literature, except with a range of about 500 years. you put a 500-year range in there, you probably got it, somewhere in there. But, yeah, that's a consequence of their not being very good historians. But what they were really, really good at was grammar. And, of course, I love grammar anyway. And but what is just so amazing, just is so satisfying, is the Sanskrit alphabet. That's where it all starts, with just the primitive sounds. And it's so logical. It's just like the periodic table. So I guess I could use the periodic table as an example, too, but I'm not a chemist, but I could go on and on. I'm not going to spend gobs of time talking about the Sanskrit alphabet, but it's arranged, and you can put it in a matrix, which I love matrices, and it all has to do with where the sound comes from. Does it come from your throat? Does it come from the back of your palate? Does it come from your mouth? Does it come from right behind your front teeth? Does it come from your lips? And you go right through the different, I'm talking about consonants now, but right through all the different consonant families, and you'll start with the one back here, then the one here, then the one here, then the one here, and then the one there. And then on to the next row, here, 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 next, here, and so forth and so on. And it's all arranged in this perfectly logical way, and it is...
Be still my heart.
Yeah, so satisfying. Well, that's the kind of thing he's talking about. It's conformable, or was that the word he used? Anyway, to reason. Everything just fits so nicely in a rational pattern. And, of course, there's no reason to doubt it, because that's the way the language was. So that's the kind of feeling that Peirce is talking about when you encounter something, and if it's a proposition, and sometimes a lot of time if it's conformable to reason, then we want to believe it. And so that's
the difference between 3 and 2.
Well, 2 is the state authority says thou shalt.
But let's take laws that reflect behavior.
Yeah.
Like you can't steal. Right?
Yeah.
The number 2 says they're backed by the authority of the state.
Mm-hmm.
But when you described number 2, it was more like a negative term to me.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas they were also agreed to by number 3, agreeable to reason that you shouldn't steal from each other.
Well, they may, in fact, have...
So are laws against things reasonable laws that most people agree with, as opposed to squashing the press?
Not necessarily.
Are they number 3 or number 2?
Not necessarily. I mean, they may agree, they may not agree. We're just talking about how the belief is fixed. So, I mean, if the law says, something that's not agreeable to reason, say.
But the law grew out of culture as opposed to, say, some big shot dictating something, you know, like, I'm the new dictator and this is how it's going to be.
It just depends. I mean, I think you're mentioning something that Peirce doesn't mention, but it would, I guess, fall under number 2, and that is, I mentioned the church and I mentioned the state, but it could also be social pressure or something like that too that pushes you to certain beliefs. That's a possibility, but that's different from believing something just because it's just so perfect and so right conformable to everything makes sense because of that. It may not in fact be true. It may be an oversimplification. I think that's the great downfall of pure rationalism, because something may be very nice and topical. For example, Comte's 3 stages of history, right? That's a good example. It's very it has that kind of feel to it. I've taken all of intellectual history now, and I'm says there were 3 stages, and that's very satisfying. Well, you know, I bet you there are exceptions to that, though. Right? When you come down from 30,000 feet down to 20,000 feet or something like that, I'm sure there are exceptions to that. So that's the kind of thing we're talking about. What you decide as a result, or what you are compelled to believe as a result of number 2, may or may not be the same as what you want to believe as a result of number 3. Right? They may be the same, they may not be the same, it just depends. So anyway, the problem with number 3, then, says Peirce, is facts. Right? For example, Comte's 3 stages and that sort of thing, well, if we look at facts, it may not work out quite so smoothly as he claims that it does. So therefore, we're finally at number four. Number four is, to satisfy our doubts, therefore, it is necessary that a method should be found by which our beliefs may be determined by nothing human, but by some external permanency, by something upon which our thinking has no effect. It must be something that affects or might affect every man, he says. Yet the method must be such that the ultimate conclusion of every man shall be the same. Such is the method of science. And by science, he's thinking of empirical science. Its fundamental hypothesis, restated in a more familiar language, is this. There are real things whose characters are entirely independent of our opinions about them. These reals affect our senses according to regular laws. And by taking advantage of the laws of perception, we can ascertain by reasoning how things really and truly are. And any man, if he have sufficient experience and he reason enough about it, will be led to the one true conclusion. Okay? So, and then he has a little tail end commentary on the whole thing. There are only thus four methods which present any distinction between a right and a wrong way. And the test of whether I'm truly following the method is not an immediate appeal to my feelings and purposes, but on the contrary itself involves the application of the method. And the best method, then, of arriving at the truth independent of my own personal preferences is the method of empirical science. That's where he's headed on that. So we have this gradual progression from the first to the fourth.
So personal logician is a number four, but Peirce the essayist there is a number three.
Peirce the magician.
The logician.
Oh, logician. Sorry. okay.
Would be number four because he had all these theorems and stuff.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, logical theorems.
Yeah.
But when he's writing stuff like this, he's a number three.
His
essay.
Good point. I see what you're saying. In other words, four methods of fixing belief. It's one of those. Right, pitter-patter type things. Yes, it's so great. Yeah.
I have a question. As I'm listening and thinking about how we believe things, I feel like he's kind of missing what seems to me the whole point, but maybe it's in there. It's just that we use our reason and mm-hmm. think about things, mm-hmm. but not in a scientific way, in a more holistic way, but in a way that's very influenced by people that shape our thinking, mm-hmm. and they show us the reason or they show us the light and we're persuaded by them.
Mm-hmm. Depends on who that is. I mean, if it's the authority, if it's an authority or something, that sounds like number two. But if it's somebody showing you the reason, as you said, for example, data, whatever, that would be number four.
Well, like, professors or mm-hmm. teachers.
Well, they
shape our thought, but,
yes.
then it's kind of fixed, and we just kind of go at it with a kind of preset opinion.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Is that it's all kind of a combination?
Yeah. Well, you know, I think he would say going at it with a preset opinion and say refusing to even consider that you may be wrong is shades of number one.
Yeah.
Right. but to Tom's point, I mean, Peirce's fourfold division is nice and satisfying intellectually, so that does sound like. The essay itself is like number three.
I'm not surprised a logician, someone with his background, wrote something like that.
Yeah. Well, of course, normally he does not write in this sort of popular style. But this is nicely written. But maybe that's the reason, that it's a number three and not a number four. Well, anyway, we didn't get to the other one, but we'll do that next time. The main one is the one coming up, which is how to make our ideas clear. And it was what Peirce said in that essay that so delighted William James and began the pragmatic movement in a public sort of way and made Peirce famous because James was famous. And James said, I owe everything to Charles Sanders Peirce. So next week we'll look at how to make our ideas clear. So yeah, we're out of time. Probably more than out of time, I bet you. Yes, more than out of time. Okay, you got everybody?
I hope so.
Yes, Sally. How to make our ideas clear.
Yeah. You're darn right. We expect a bit of clarity in here. I'll enforce it.
It's a matter of belief.
Good luck with your first week off.
Jay retired Friday.
Oh, really? Well, congratulations. Good for you.
I saw one.
It was
not one of those little kitchen ones.
So I was asking, what's he going to do tomorrow when he wakes up?
Oh, that's a big deal.
There's a roach.
When did I recognize him? I don't know if I recognize him. Well, that's what I had. That's so weird. So I killed it with a got it like a lot of sand, and I'm thinking like, oh, this has to be the only one. Because my husband's
well, that's one day.
And I've never seen one before. This has to look weird.
It's been
the next woman
been
comes
great
in.
So far.
Yeah.
Less than 2 days
into it. Yeah. Well, there's plenty of low-wage jobs today if you want to get a little pocket change.
One clock at the wall where her towel
is. Bookstores are hiring.
Would you like fries with that? I don't see Jay as a barista.
I see Jay more at Politics and Pros.
Yes, that's right. Yeah, that's a good one.
Not, sorry.